She hoped there would be food for them in the land of the dead. Then, suddenly, there was the boat. It was an ancient rowboat, battered, patched, rotting, and the figure rowing it was aged beyond age, huddled in a robe of sacking bound with string, crippled and bent, his bony hands crooked permanently around the oar handles, and his moist, pale eyes sunk deep among folds and wrinkles of grey skin. He let go of an oar and reached his crooked hand up to the iron ring set in the post at the corner of the jetty. With the other hand he moved the oar to bring the boat right up against the planks. There was no need to speak. Will got in first, and then Lyra came forward to step down, too. But the boatman held up his hand.
"Not him," he said.
"Not who?"
"Not him."
He extended a yellow-grey finger, pointing directly at Pantalaimon, whose red-brown, stoked form immediately became ermine-white.
"But he is me."
"If you come, he must stay."
"But we can't. We die."
"Isn't that what you want?"
And then, for the first time, Lyra truly realized what she was doing. This was the real consequence. She stood aghast, trembling, and clutched her dear demon so tightly that he whimpered in pain.
"They..."
said Lyra helplessly, then stopped. It wasn't fair to point out that the other three didn't have to give anything up. Will was watching her anxiously. She looked all around, at the lake, at the jetty, at the rough path, the stagnant puddles, the dead and sodden bushes. Her Pan, alone here. How could he live without her? He was shaking inside her shirt, against her bare flesh, his fur needing her warmth. Impossible! Never!
"He must stay here if you are to come."
The Lady Salmakia flicked the rein, and her dragonfly skimmed away from Lyra's shoulder to land on the gunwale of the boat, where Tialis joined her. They said something to the boatman. Lyra watched as a condemned prisoner watches the stir at the back of the courtroom that might be a messenger with a pardon. The boatman bent to listen and then shook his head.
"No. If she comes, he has to stay."
"That's not right. We don't have to leave part of ourselves behind. Why should Lyra?"
"No, but you do. It's her misfortune that she can see and talk to the part she must leave. You will not know until you are on the water, and then it will be too late. But you all have to leave that part of yourselves here. There is no passage to the land of the dead for such as him."
"No," Lyra thought, and Pantalaimon thought with her. "We didn't go through Bolvanger for this. No. How will we ever find each other again?" And she looked back again at the foul and dismal shore, so bleak and blasted with disease and poison, and thought of her dear Pan waiting there alone, her heart's companion, watching her disappear into the mist, and she fell into a storm of weeping. Her passionate sobs didn't echo because the mist muffled them, but all along the shore, in innumerable ponds and shallows, in wretched broken tree stumps, the damaged creatures that lurked there heard her full-hearted cry and drew themselves a little closer to the ground, afraid of such passion.
"If he could come,"
cried Will, desperate to end her grief, but the boatman shook his head.
"He can come in the boat, but if he does, the boat stays here."
"But how will she find him again?"
"I don't know."
"When we leave, will we come back this way?"
"Leave?"
"We're going to come back. We're going to the land of the dead, and we are going to come back."
"Not this way."
"Then some other way, but we will."
"I have taken millions, and none came back."
"Then we shall be the first. We'll find our way out. And since we're going to do that, be kind, boatman. Be compassionate. Let her take her demon."
"No."
He shook his ancient head.
"It's not a rule you can break. It's a law, like this one."
He leaned over the side and cupped a handful of water and then tilted his hand so it ran out again.
"The law that makes the water fall back into the lake. It's a law like that. I can't tilt my hand and make the water fly upward. No more can I take her demon to the land of the dead. Whether or not she comes, he must stay."
Lyra could see nothing. Her face was buried in Pantalaimon's cat fur. But Will saw Tialis dismount from his dragonfly and prepare to spring at the boatman, and he half agreed with the spy's intention. But the old man had seen him, and turned his ancient head to say,
"How many ages do you think I've been ferrying people to the land of the dead? Do you think if anything could hurt me, it wouldn't have happened already? Do you think the people I take come with me gladly? They struggle and cry. They try to bribe me. They threaten and fight. Nothing works. You can't hurt me, sting as you will. Better comfort the child. She's coming. Take no notice of me."
Will could hardly watch. Lyra was doing the cruelest thing she had ever done. Hating herself, hating the deed, suffering for Pan and with Pan and because of Pan, trying to put him down on the cold path, disengaging his cat claws from her clothes, weeping, weeping. Will closed his ears. The sound was too unhappy to bear. Time after time she pushed her demon away, and still he cried and tried to cling. She could turn back. She could say, "No, this is a bad idea, we mustn't do it." She could be true to the heart-deep, life-deep bond linking her to Pantolimon. She could put that first. She could push the rest out of her mind. But she couldn't.
"Pan, no one's done this before. But Will says we're coming back. And I swear, Pan, I love you. I swear we're coming back. I will. Take care, my dear. You'll be safe. We will come back. And if I have to spend every minute of my life finding you again, I will. I won't stop. I won't rest. I won't... Oh, Pan. Dear Pan. I've got to.
And she pushed him away, so that he crouched bitter and cold and frightened on the muddy ground. What animal he was now, Will could hardly tell. He seemed to be so young, a cub, a puppy, something helpless and beaten, a creature so sunk in misery that it was more misery than creature. His eyes never left Lyra's face, and Will could see her making herself not look away, not avoid the guilt. And he admired her honesty and her courage, at the same time as he was wrenched with the shock of their parting. There were so many vivid currents of feeling between them that the very air felt electric to him. And Pantolimon didn't ask why, because he knew. And he didn't ask whether Lyra loved Roger more than him, because he knew the true answer to that, too. And he knew that if he spoke, she wouldn't be able to resist. So the demon held himself quiet so as not to distress the human who was abandoning him. And now they were both pretending that it wouldn't hurt, it wouldn't be long before they were together again. It was all for the best. But Will knew that the little girl was tearing her heart out of her breast. Then she stepped down into the boat. She was so light that it barely rocked at all. She sat beside Will, and her eyes never left Pantolimon, who stood trembling at the shore end of the jetty. But as the boatman let go of the iron ring and swung his oars out to pull the boat away, the little dog demon trotted helplessly out to the very end, his claws clicking softly on the soft planks, and stood watching, just watching, as the boat drew away and the jetty faded and vanished in the mist. Then Lyra gave a cry so passionate that even in that muffled, mist-hung world it raised an echo. But of course it wasn't an echo. It was the other part of her crying in turn from the land of the living as Lyra moved away into the land of the dead.
"My heart, Will!"
She clung to him, her wet face contorted with pain. And thus the prophecy that the Master of Jordan College had made to the librarian, that Lyra would make a great betrayal and it would hurt her terribly, was fulfilled. But Will, too, found an agony building inside him, and through the pain he saw that the two Gallivespians, clinging together just as he and Lyra were doing, were moved by the same anguish. Part of it was physical. It felt as if an iron hand had gripped his heart and was pulling it out between his ribs, so that he pressed his hands to the place and vainly tried to hold it in. It was far deeper and far worse than the pain of losing his fingers. But it was mental, too. Something secret and private was being dragged into the open, where it had no wish to be. And Will was nearly overcome by a mixture of pain and shame and fear and self-reproach, because he himself had caused it. And it was worse than that. It was as if he'd said, "No, don't kill me, I'm frightened. Kill my mother instead. She doesn't matter, I don't love her." And as if she'd heard him say it, and pretended she hadn't so as to spare his feelings, and offered herself in his place anyway because of her love for him. He felt as bad as that. There was nothing worse to feel. So Will knew that all those things were part of having a demon, and that whatever his demon was, she too was left behind with Pantalaimon on that poisoned and desolate shore. The thought came to Will and Lyra at the same moment, and they exchanged a tear-filled glance. And for the second time in their lives, but not the last, each of them saw their own expression on the other's face. Only the boatman and the dragonflies seemed indifferent to the journey they were making. The great insects were fully alive and bright with beauty even in the clinging mist, shaking their filmy wings to dislodge the moisture. And the old man in his sacking robe leaned forward and back, bracing his bare feet against the slime-puddled floor. The journey lasted longer than Lyra wanted to measure. Though part of her was raw with anguish, imagining Pantalaimon abandoned on the shore, another part was adjusting to the pain, measuring her own strength, curious to see what would happen and where they would land. Will's arm was strong around her, but he too was looking ahead, trying to peer through the wet grey gloom and to hear anything other than the dank splash of the oars. And presently something did change. A cliff or an island lay ahead of them. They heard the enclosing of the sound before they saw the mist darken. The boatman pulled on one oar to turn the boat a little to the left.
"Where are we?"
said the voice of the Chevalier Tialis, small but strong as ever, though there was a harsh edge to it, as if he too had been suffering pain.
"Near the island," said the boatman. "Another 5 minutes, we'll be at the landing stage."
"What island?"
said Will. He found his own voice strained, too, so tight it hardly seemed his.
"The gate to the land of the dead is on this island. Everyone comes here. Kings, queens, murderers, poets, children. Everyone comes this way, and none come back."
"We shall come back."
The boatman said nothing, but his ancient eyes were full of pity. As they moved closer, they could see branches of cypress and yew hanging down low over the water, dark green, dense, and gloomy. The land rose steeply, and the trees grew so thickly that hardly a ferret could slip between them. And at that thought, Lyra gave a little half-hiccup, half-sob, for Pan would have shown her how well he could do it. But not now. Maybe not ever again.
"Are we dead now?"
"Makes no difference. There's some that came here never believing they were dead. They insisted all the way that they were alive. It was a mistake. Someone would have to pay. Made no difference. There's others who longed to be dead when they were alive, poor souls. Lives full of pain or misery, killed themselves for a chance of a blessed rest, and found that nothing had changed except for the worse. And this time, there was no escape. You can't make yourself alive again. And there's been others, so frail and sickly, little infants sometimes, that they're scarcely born into the living before they come down to the dead. I've rowed this boat with a little crying baby on my lap many, many times, that never knew the difference between up there and down here. And old folk, too. The rich ones are the worst, snarling and savage and cursing me, railing and screaming. What did I think I was? Hadn't they gathered and saved all the gold they could garner? Wouldn't I take some now to put them back ashore? They'd have the law on me. They had powerful friends. They knew the Pope, and the King of this, and the Duke of that. They were in a position to see I was punished and chastised. But they knew what the truth was in the end. The only position they were in was in my boat, going to the land of the dead. And as for those kings and popes, they'd be in here too in their turn, sooner than they wanted. I let him cry and rave. They can't hurt me. They fall silent in the end. So if you don't know whether you're dead or not, and the little girl swears blind she'll come out again to the living, I say nothing to contradict you. What you are, you'll know soon enough."
All the time he had been steadily rowing along the shore, and now he shipped the oars, slipping the handles down inside the boat and reaching out to his right for the first wooden post that rose out of the lake. He pulled the boat alongside the narrow wharf and held it still for them. Lyra didn't want to get out. As long as she was near the boat, then Pantalaimon would be able to think of her properly because that was how he last saw her. But when she moved away from it, he wouldn't know how to picture her anymore. So she hesitated, but the dragonflies flew up and Will got out, pale and clutching his chest. So she had to as well.
"Thank you,"
she said to the boatman.
"When you go back, if you see my demon, tell him I love him the best of everything in the land of the living or the dead, and I swear I'll come back to him, even if no one's ever done it before. I swear I will."
"Yes, I'll tell him that," said the old boatman.
He pushed off and the sound of his slow oar strokes faded away in the mist. The Gallivespians flew back, having gone a little way, and perched on the children's shoulders as before, she on Lyra, he on Will. So they stood, the travellers, at the edge of the land of the dead. Ahead of them there was nothing but mist, though they could see from the darkening of it that a great wall rose in front of them. Lyra shivered. She felt as if her skin had turned into lace and the damp and bitter air could flow in and out of her ribs, scaldingly cold on the raw wound where Pantalaimon had been. Still, she thought, Roger must have felt like that as he plunged down the mountainside, trying to cling to her desperate fingers. They stood still and listened. The only sound was an endless drip, drip, drip of water from the leaves, and as they looked up they felt one or two drops splash coldly on their cheeks.
"Can't stay here,"
said Lyra. They moved off the wharf, keeping close together, and made their way to the wall. Gigantic stone blocks, green with ancient slime, rose higher into the mist than they could see. And now that they were closer, they could hear the sound of cries behind it, though whether they were human voices crying was impossible to tell. High, mournful shrieks and wails that hung in the air like the drifting filaments of a jellyfish, causing pain wherever they touched.
"There's a door,"
said Will. It was a battered wooden postern under a slab of stone. Before Will could lift his hand and open it, one of those high, harsh cries sounded very close by, jarring their ears and frightening them horribly. Immediately the Gallivespians darted into the air, the dragonflies like little war horses eager for battle. But the thing that flew down swept them aside with a brutal blow from her wing and then settled heavily on a ledge just above the children's heads. Dialis and Salmakia gathered themselves and soothed their shaken mounts. The thing was a great bird, the size of a vulture, with the face and breasts of a woman. Will had seen pictures of creatures like her, and the word harpy came to mind as soon as he saw her clearly. Her face was smooth and unwrinkled, but aged beyond even the age of the witches. She had seen thousands of years pass, and the cruelty and misery of all of them had formed the hateful expression on her features. But as the travellers saw her more clearly, she became even more repulsive. Her eye sockets were clotted with filthy slime, and the redness of her lips was caked and crusted as if she had vomited ancient blood again and again. Her matted, filthy black hair hung down to her shoulders. Her jagged claws gripped the stone fiercely. Her powerful dark wings were folded along her back, and a drift of putrescent stink wafted from her every time she moved. Will and Lyra, both of them sick and full of pain, tried to stand upright and face her.
"But you are alive,"
the harpy said, her harsh voice mocking them. Will found himself hating and fearing her more than any human being he had ever known.
"Who are you?"
said Lyra, who was just as repelled as Will. For answer, the harpy screamed. She opened her mouth and directed a jet of noise right in their faces, so that their heads rang and they nearly fell backwards. Will clutched at Lyra, and they both clung together as the scream turned into wild, mocking peals of laughter, which were answered by other harpy voices in the fog along the shore. The jeering, hate-filled sound reminded Will of the merciless cruelty of children in a playground. But there were no teachers here to regulate things, no one to appeal to, nowhere to hide. He set his hand on the knife at his belt and looked her in the eyes, though his head was ringing and the sheer power of her scream had made him dizzy.
"If you're trying to stop us, then you'd better be ready to fight as well as scream, because we're going through that door."
The harpy's sickening red mouth moved again, but this time it was to purse her lips into a mock kiss.
"Your mother is alone. We shall send her nightmares. We shall scream at her in her sleep.
Will didn't move, because out of the corner of his eye he could see the Lady Salmakia moving delicately along the branch where the harpy was perching. Her dragonfly, wings quivering, was being held by Tialis on the ground. And then two things happened. The lady leapt at the harpy and spun around to dig her spur deep into the creature's scaly leg, and Tialis launched the dragonfly upwards. In less than a second, Salmakia had spun away and leapt off the branch, directly onto the back of her electric blue steed, and up into the air. The effect on the harpy was immediate. Another scream shattered the silence, much louder than before, and she beat her dark wings so hard that Will and Lyra both felt the wind and staggered. But she clung to the stone with her claws, and her face was suffused with dark red anger, and her hair stood out from her head like a crest of serpents. Will tugged at Lyra's hand, and they both tried to run towards the door, but the harpy launched herself at them in a fury and only pulled up from the dive when Will turned, thrusting Lyra behind him and holding up the knife. The Gallivespians were on her at once, darting close at her face and then darting away again, unable to get in a blow but distracting her so that she beat her wings clumsily and half fell onto the ground.
Tialis! Salmakia! Stop! Stop!
The spies reined back their dragonflies and skimmed high over the children's heads. Other dark forms were clustering in the fog, and the jeering screams of 100 more harpies sounded from further along the shore. The first one was shaking her wings, shaking her hair, stretching each leg in turn and flexing her claws. She was unhurt, and that was what Lyra had noticed. The Gallivespians hovered and then dived back towards Lyra, who was holding out both hands for them to land on. Salmakia realized what Lyra had meant, and said to Tialis,
"She's right. We can't hurt her for some reason."
"Lady, what's your name?"
The harpy shook her wings wide, and the travellers nearly fainted from the hideous smells of corruption and decay that wafted from her.
"No name!"
"What do you want with us?"
"What can you give me?"
"We could tell you where we've been, and maybe you'd be interested. I don't know. We saw all kinds of strange things on the way here."
"Oh? And you're offering to tell me a story?"
"If you'd like."
"Maybe I would. And what then?"
"You might let us go in through that door and find the ghost we've come here to look for. I hope you would anyway, if you'd be so kind."
"Try, then."
And even in her sickness and pain, Lyra felt that she'd just been dealt the ace of trumps.
"Oh, be careful,"
whispered Salmakia, but Lyra's mind was already racing ahead through the story she'd told the night before, shaping and cutting and improving and adding, parents dead, family treasure, shipwreck, escape.
"Well,"
she said, settling into her storytelling frame of mind,
"it began when I was a baby, really. My father and mother were the Duke and Duchess of Abingdon, you see, and they were as rich as anything. My father was one of the king's advisers, and the king himself used to come and stay, all the time. They'd go hunting in our forest. The house there, where I was born, it was the biggest house in the whole south of England. It was called..."
Without even a cry of warning, the harpy launched herself at Lyra, claws outstretched. Lyra just had time to duck, but still one of the claws caught her scalp and tore out a clump of hair.
"Liar! Liar! Liar!"
She flew around again, aiming directly for Lyra's face, but Will took out the knife and threw himself in the way. No Name swerved out of reach just in time, and Will hustled Lyra over towards the door because she was numb with shock and half-blinded by the blood running down her face. Where the Gallivespians were, Will had no idea, but the harpy was flying at them again and screaming in rage and hatred.
"Liar! Liar! Liar!"
And it sounded as if her voice were coming from everywhere, and the word echoed back from the great wall in the fog, muffled and changed, so that she seemed to be screaming Lyra's name, so that Lyra and liar were one and the same thing. Will had Lyra pressed against his chest, with his shoulder curved over to protect her, and he felt her shaking and sobbing against him. But then he thrust the knife into the rotten wood of the door and cut out the lock with a quick slash of the blade. Then he and Lyra, with the spies beside them on their darting dragonflies, tumbled through into the realm of the ghosts, as the harpy's cry was doubled and redoubled by others on the foggy shore behind them. Chapter 22. The Whisperers.
Thick as autumnal leaves that strow the brooks in Vallombrosa, where the Etrurian shades high overarched Imbaua. John Milton.
The first thing Will did was to make Lyra sit down, and then he took out the little pot of blood moss ointment and looked at the wound on her head. It was bleeding freely, as scalp wounds do, but it wasn't deep. He tore a strip off the edge of his shirt and mopped it clean, and spread some of the ointment over the gash, trying not to think of the filthy state of the claw that made it. Lyra's eyes were glazed, and she was ash pale.
"Lyra. Lyra,"
he said, and shook her gently.
"Come on now. We've got to move."
She gave a shudder and took a long, shaky breath, and her eyes focused on him, full of a wild despair.
"Will, I can't do it anymore. I can't do it. I can't tell lies. I thought it was so easy, but it didn't work. It's all I can do, and it doesn't work."
"It's not all you can do. You can read the alethiometer, can't you? Come on, let's see where we are. Let's look for Roger."
He helped her up, and for the first time they looked around at the land where the ghosts were. They found themselves on a great plain that extended far ahead into the mist. The light by which they saw was a dull self-luminescence that seemed to exist everywhere equally, so that there were no true shadows and no true light, and everything was the same dingy color. Standing on the floor of this huge space were adults and children, ghost people, so many that Lyra couldn't guess their number. At least, most of them were standing, though some were sitting and some lying down, listless or asleep. No one was moving about or running or playing, though many of them turned to look at these new arrivals with a fearful curiosity in their wide eyes.
"Ghosts! This is where they all are. Everyone that's ever died."
No doubt it was because she didn't have Pantalaimon anymore, but she clung close to Will's arm, and he was glad she did. The Gallivespians had flown ahead, and he could see their bright little forms darting and skimming over the heads of the ghosts, who looked up and followed them with wonder. But the silence was immense and oppressive, and the grey light filled him with fear, and Lyra's warm presence beside him was the only thing that felt like life. Behind them, outside the wall, the screams of the harpies were still echoing up and down the shore. Some of the ghost people were looking up apprehensively, but more of them were staring at Will and Lyra, and then they began to crowd forward. Lyra shrank back. She didn't have the strength just yet to face them as she would have liked to do, and it was Will who had to speak first.
"Do you speak our language? Can you speak at all?"
Shivering and frightened and full of pain as he and Lyra were, they had more authority than the whole mass of the dead put together. These poor ghosts had little power of their own, and hearing Will's voice, the first clear voice that had sounded there in all the memory of the dead, many of them came forward, eager to respond. But they could only whisper. A faint, pale sound, no more than a soft breath, was all they could utter. And as they thrust forward, jostling and desperate, the Gallivespians flew down and darted to and fro in front of them, to prevent them from crowding too close. The ghost children looked up with a passionate longing, and Lyra knew at once why. They thought the dragonflies were demons. They were wishing with all their hearts that they could hold their own demons again.
"Oh, they ain't demons. And if my own demon was here, you could all stroke him and touch him, I promise."
And she held out her hands to the children. The adult ghosts hung back, listless or fearful, but the children all came thronging forward. They had as much substance as fog, poor things, and Lyra's hands passed through and through them, as did Will's. They crammed forward, light and lifeless, to warm themselves at the flowing blood and the strong beating hearts of the two travellers, and both Will and Lyra felt a succession of cold, delicate brushing sensations as the ghosts passed through their bodies, warming themselves on the way. The two living children felt that little by little they were becoming dead too. They hadn't got an infinite amount of life and warmth to give, and they were so cold already, and the endless crowds pressing forward looked as if they were never going to stop. Finally, Lyra had to plead with them to hold back. She held up her hands and said,
"Please, we wish we could touch you all, but we came down here to look for someone, and I need you to tell me where he is and how to find him. Oh, Will,"
she said, leaning her head to his,
"I wish I knew what to do."
The ghosts were fascinated by the blood on Lyra's forehead. It glowed as brightly as a holly berry in the dimness, and several of them had brushed through it, longing for the contact with something so vibrantly alive. One ghost girl, who when she was alive must have been about 9 or 10, reached up shyly to try and touch it, and then shrank back in fear. but Lyra said,
"Don't be afraid. We ain't come here to hurt you. Speak to us, if you can."
The ghost girl spoke, but in her thin, pale voice it was only a whisper.
"Did the harpies do that? Did they try and hurt you?"
"Yeah,"
said Lyra.
"But if that's all they can do, I ain't worried about them."
"Oh, it isn't... Oh, they do worse."
"What? What do they do?"
But they were reluctant to tell her. They shook their heads and kept silent, until one boy said,
It ain't so bad for them that's been here hundreds of years, because you get tired after all that time. They can't fraid you up so much."
"It's the new ones that they like talking to most. It's just... Oh, it's just hateful. They... I can't tell you."
Their voices were no louder than dry leaves falling. And it was only the children who spoke. The adults all seemed sunk in a lethargy so ancient that they might never move or speak again.
"Listen. Please, listen. We came here, me and my friends, because we got to find a boy called Roger. He ain't been here long, just a few weeks, so he won't know very many people. But if you know where he is..."
But even as she spoke, she knew that they could stay here till they grew old, searching everywhere and looking at every face, and still they might never see more than a tiny fraction of the dead. She felt despair sit on her shoulders, as heavy as if the harpy herself were perching there. However, she clenched her teeth and tried to hold her chin high. "We got here," she thought. "That's part of it anyway." The first ghost girl was saying something in that lost little whisper.
"Why do we want to find him?"
said Will.
"Well, Lyra wants to speak to him. But there's someone I want to find as well. I want to find my father, John Parry. He's here too somewhere, and I want to speak to him before I go back to the world. So please ask, if you can, ask for Roger and for John Parry to come and speak to Lyra and to Will. Ask them..."
But suddenly the ghosts all turned and fled, even the grown-ups, like dry leaves scattered by a sudden gust of wind. In a moment the space around the children was empty, and then they heard why. Screams, cries, shrieks came from the air above, and then the harpies were on them with gusts of rotten stink, battering wings, and those raucous screams, jeering, mocking, cackling, deriding. Lyra shrank to the ground at once, covering her ears, and Will, knife in hand, crouched over her. He could see Tialis and Salmakia skimming towards them, but they were some way off yet, and he had a moment or two to watch the harpies as they wheeled and dived. He saw their human faces snap at the air as if they were eating insects, and he heard the words they were shouting, scoffing words, filthy words, all about his mother, words that shook his heart. But part of his mind was quite cold and separate, thinking, calculating, observing. None of them wanted to come anywhere near the knife. To see what would happen, he stood up. One of them, it might have been No Name herself, had to swerve heavily out of the way because she'd been diving low, intending to skim just over his head. Her heavy wings beat clumsily, and she only just made the turn. He could have reached out and slashed off her head with the knife. By this time the Gallivespians had arrived, and the two of them were about to attack, but Will called,
"Tialis, come here. Salmakia, come to my hand."
They landed on his shoulders, and he said,
"Watch. See what they do. They only come and scream. I think it was a mistake when she hit Lyra. I don't think they want to touch us at all. We can ignore them."
Lyra looked up, wide-eyed. The creatures flew around Will's head, sometimes only a foot or so away, but they always swerved aside or upwards at the last moment. He could sense the two spies eager for battle, and the dragonfly's wings were quivering with desire to dart through the air with their deadly riders, but they held themselves back. They could see he was right. And it had an effect on the ghosts, too. Seeing Will standing unafraid and unharmed, they began to drift back towards the travellers. They watched the harpies cautiously, but for all that, the lure of the warm flesh and blood, those strong heartbeats, was too much to resist. Lyra stood up to join Will. Her wound had opened again, and fresh blood was trickling down her cheek, but she wiped it aside.
"Will, I'm so glad we came down here together."
He heard a tone in her voice, and he saw an expression on her face that he knew and liked more than anything he'd ever known. It showed she was thinking of something daring, but she wasn't ready to speak of it yet. He nodded, to show he'd understood. The ghost girl said,
"This way. Come with us. We'll find them."
and both of them felt the strangest sensation, as if little ghost hands were reaching inside and tugging at their ribs to make them follow. So they set off across the floor of that great desolate plain, and the harpies wheeled higher and higher overhead, screaming and screaming. But they kept their distance, and the Gallivespians flew above, keeping watch. As they walked along, the ghosts talked to them.
"Excuse me,"
said one ghost girl.
"But where's your demons? Excuse me for asking, but..."
Lyra was conscious every single second of her dear abandoned Pantalaimon. She couldn't speak easily, so Will answered instead.
"We left our demons outside, where it's safe for them. We'll collect them later. Did you have a demon?"
"Yes, his name was Sandling. Oh, I loved him."
"And had he settled?"
said Lyra.
"No, not yet. He used to think he'd be a bird, and I hoped he wouldn't, because I liked him all furry in bed at night. But he was a bird more and more. What's your demon called?"
Lyra told her, and the ghosts pressed forward eagerly again. They all wanted to talk about their demons, every one.
"Mine was called Matapan.
We used to play hide-and-seek. She changed like a chameleon, and I couldn't see her at all. She was ever so good.
Once I hurt my eye, and I couldn't see, and he guided me all the way home.
He never wanted to settle, but I wanted to grow up, and we used to argue. She used to curl up in my hand and go to sleep."
"Are they still there? Somewhere else? Will we see them again?"
"No. When you die, your demon just goes out like a candle flame. I seen it happen. I never saw my caster, though. I never said goodbye."
"They ain't nowhere. They must be somewhere. My demon's still there, somewhere. I know he is."
The jostling ghosts were animated and eager, their eyes shining and their cheeks warm, as if they were borrowing life from the travellers. Will said,
"Is there anyone here from my world, where we don't have demons?"
A thin ghost boy of his own age nodded, and Will turned to him.
"Oh, yes. We didn't understand what demons were, but we knew what it felt like to be without them. There's people here from all kinds of worlds."
"I knew my dad. I knew him all the while I was growing up. When I heard them talk about demons, I thought they meant something like our deaths. I miss him now. I will never see him again. I'm over and done with. That's the last thing he said to me, and then he went forever. When he was with me, I always knew there was someone I could trust, someone who knew where we was going and what to do. But I ain't got him no more. I don't know what's going to happen ever again."
"There ain't nothing going to happen. Nothing forever."
"You don't know. They came, didn't they? No one ever knew that was going to happen."
She meant Will and Lyra.
"This is the first thing that ever happened here. Maybe it's all going to change now."
"What would you do if you could?"
said Lyra.
"Go up to the world again."
"Even if it meant you could only see it once, would you still want to do that?"
Yes!
"Well, anyway, I've got to find Roger,"
said Lyra, burning with her new idea. But it was for Will to know first. On the floor of the endless plain, there was a vast, slow movement among the uncountable ghosts. The children couldn't see it, but Tialis and Salmakia, flying above, watched the little pale figures all moving with an effect that looked like the migration of immense flocks of birds or herds of reindeer. At the center of the movement were the two children who were not ghosts, moving steadily on. Not leading and not following, but somehow focusing the movement into an intention of all the dead. The spies, their thoughts moving even more quickly than their darting steeds, exchanged a glance and brought the dragonflies to rest side by side on a dry, withered branch.
"Do we have demons, Tialis?"
"Since we got into that boat, I have felt as if my heart had been torn out and thrown still beating on the shore. But it wasn't. It's still working in my breast. So something of mine is out there with the little girl's demon. And something of yours too, Salmakia, because your face is drawn, and your hands are pale and tight. Yes, we have demons, whatever they are. Maybe the people in Lyra's world are the only living beings to know they have. Maybe that's why it was one of them who started the revolt."
He slipped off the dragonfly's back and tethered it safely, and then took out the lodestone resonator. But he had hardly begun to touch it when he stopped.
"No response."
"So we're beyond everything?"
"Beyond help, certainly. Well, we knew we were coming to the land of the dead."
"The boy would go with her to the end of the world."
"Will his knife open the way back, do you think?"
"I'm sure he thinks so. But, oh, Tialis, I don't know."
"He's very young. Well, they are both young. You know, if she doesn't survive this, the question of whether she'll choose the right thing when she's tempted won't arise. It won't matter anymore.
Do you think she's chosen already? When she chose to leave her demon on the shore, was that the choice she had to make?
The Chevalier looked down on the slow-moving millions on the floor of the Land of the Dead, all drifting after that bright and living spark Lyra Silvertongue. He could just make out her hair, the lightest thing in the gloom, and beside it the boy's head, black-haired and solid and strong.
No, not yet. That's still to come, whatever it may be.
Then we must bring her to it safely.
Bring them both. They're bound together now.
The Lady Salmakia flicked the cobweb light rein, and her dragonfly darted off the branch at once and sped down towards the living children, with the Chevalier close behind. But they didn't stop with them. Having skimmed low to make sure they were all right, they flew on ahead, partly because the dragonflies were restless, and partly because they wanted to find out how far this dismal place extended. Lyra saw them flashing overhead, and felt a pang of relief that there was still something that darted and glowed with beauty. Then, unable to keep her idea to herself any more, she turned to Will, but she had to whisper. She put her lips to his ear, and in a noisy rush of warmth, he heard her say,
"Will, I want us to take all these poor dead ghost kids outside. The grown-ups as well. We could set them free. We'll find Roger and your father, and then let's open the way to the world outside and set them all free."
He turned and gave her a true smile, so warm and happy she felt something stumble and falter inside her. At least it felt like that, but without Pantalaimon she couldn't ask herself what it meant. It might have been a new way for her heart to beat. Deeply surprised, she told herself to walk straight and stop feeling giddy. So they moved on. The whisper, "Roger," was spreading out faster than they could move. The words, "Roger, Lyra's come. Roger, Lyra's here," passed from one ghost to another like the electric message that one cell in the body passes on to the next. And Tialis and Salmakia, cruising above on their tireless dragonflies, and looking all around as they flew, eventually noticed a new kind of movement. Some way off, there was a little gyration of activity. Skimming down closer, they found themselves ignored for the first time, because something more interesting was gripping the minds of all the ghosts. They were talking excitedly in their near-silent whispers. They were pointing. They were urging someone forwards. Salmakia flew down low but couldn't land. The press was too great, and none of their hands or shoulders would support her, even if they dared to try. She saw a young ghost boy with an honest, unhappy face, dazed and puzzled by what he was being told, and she called out,
"Roger? Is that Roger?"
He looked up, bemused, nervous, and nodded. Salmakia flew back up to her companion, and together they sped back to Lyra. It was a long way and hard to navigate, but by watching the patterns of movement, they finally found her.
"There she is. Lyra! Lyra, your friend is there!"
Lyra looked up and held out her hand for the dragonfly. The great insect landed at once, its red and yellow gleaming like enamel, and its filmy wings stiff and still on either side. Tialis kept his balance as she held him at eye level.
"Where? Is he far off?"
"An hour's walk. But he knows you're coming. The others have told him, and we made sure it was him. Just keep going, and soon you'll find him."
Tialis saw Will make the effort to stand up straight and force himself to find some more energy. Lyra was charged with it already, and plied the Gallivespians with questions. How did Roger seem? Had he spoken to them? No, of course. But did he seem glad? Were the other children aware of what was happening, and were they helping, or were they just in the way? And so on. Tialis tried to answer everything truthfully and patiently. And step by step the living girl drew closer to the boy she had brought to his death. Chapter 23 No Way Out.
"And ye shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." The Gospel of St. John.
"Will,"
said Lyra,
"what do you think the harpies will do when we let the ghosts out?"
Because the creatures were getting louder and flying closer, and there were more and more of them all the time, as if the gloom were gathering itself into little clots of malice and giving them wings. The ghosts kept looking up fearfully.
"Are we getting close?"
Lyra called to the Lady Salmakia.
"Not far now,"
she called down, hovering above them.
"You could see him if you climbed that rock."
But Lyra didn't want to waste time. She was trying with all her heart to put on a cheerful face for Roger, but every moment in front of her mind's eye was that terrible image of the little dog Pan, abandoned on the jetty as the mist closed around him, and she could barely keep from howling. She must, though. She must be hopeful for Roger. She always had been. When they did come face to face, it happened quite suddenly. In among the press of all the ghosts, there he was, his familiar features wan, but his expression as full of delight as a ghost could be. He rushed to embrace her, but he passed like cold smoke through her arms, and though she felt his little hand clutch at her heart, it had no strength to hold on. They could never truly touch again. But he could whisper, and his voice said,
"Lyra, I never thought I'd ever see you again. I thought even if you did come down here when you was dead, you'd be much older. You'd be a grown-up, and you wouldn't want to speak to me."
"Why ever not?"
"Because I'd done the wrong thing when Pan got my demon away from Lord Asriel's. We should have run. We shouldn't have tried to fight her. We should have run to you. Then she wouldn't have been able to get my demon again. And when the cliff fell away, my demon would have still been with me."
"But that weren't your fault, stupid. It was me that brung you there in the first place. And I should have let you go back with the other kids and the Egyptians. It was my fault. I'm so sorry, Roger. Honest, it was my fault. You wouldn't have been here otherwise."
"Well, I don't know. Maybe I would have got dead some other way. But it weren't your fault, Lyra, see?"
She felt herself beginning to believe it. But all the same, it was heart-rending to see the poor little cold thing, so close and yet so out of reach. She tried to grasp his wrist, though her fingers closed in the empty air, but he understood and sat down beside her. The other ghosts withdrew a little, leaving them alone, and Will moved apart, too, to sit down and nurse his hand. It was bleeding again, and while Tialis flew fiercely at the ghosts to force them away, Salmakia helped Will tend to the wound. But Lyra and Roger were oblivious to that.
"And you ain't dead. How'd you come here if you're still alive? And where's Pan?"
"Oh, Roger, I had to leave him on the shore. It was the worst thing I ever had to do. It hurts so much. You know how it hurts. And he just stood there, just looking... Oh, I felt like a murderer, Roger. But I had to, or else I couldn't have come."
"I've been pretending to talk to you all the time since I died. I've been wishing I could and wishing so hard, just wishing I could get out. Me and all the other dead ones, because this is a terrible place, Lyra. It's hopeless. There's no change when you're dead. And them bird things, you know what they do? They wait till you're resting. You can't never sleep properly. You just sort of doze, and they come up quiet beside you, and they whisper all the bad things you ever did when you was alive, so you can't forget them. They know all the worst things about you. They know how to make you feel horrible, just thinking of all the stupid things and bad things you ever did. And all the greedy and unkind thoughts you ever had, they know them all. And they shame you up, and they make you feel sick with yourself. But you can't get away from them."
"Well, listen."
Dropping her voice and leaning closer to the little ghost, just as she used to do when they were planning mischief at Jordan, she went on.
"You probably don't know, but the witches... You remember Serafina Pekala? The witches have got a prophecy about me. They don't know I know. No one does. I never spoke to anyone about it before. But when I was in Trollesund, and Father Coram, the Egyptian, took me to see the witch's consul, Dr. Lancelius, he gave me like a kind of a test. He said I had to go outside and pick out the right piece of cloudpine out of all the others to show I could really read the alethiometer. Well, I done that, and then I came in quickly because it was cold, and it only took a second. It was easy. The consul was talking to Father Coram, and they didn't know I could hear him. He said the witches had this prophecy about me. I was going to do something great and important, and it was going to be in another world. Only I never spoke of it, and I reckon I must have even forgot it. There was so much else going on, so it sort of sunk out of my mind. I never even talked about it with Pan, because he would have laughed, I reckon. But then, later on, Mrs. Coulter caught me, and I was in a trance, and I was dreaming. And I dreamed of that, and I dreamed of you. And I remembered the Egyptian boat mother, Mar Costa, you remember? It was their boat we got on board of, in Jericho,
with Simon and Hugh and them?
Yes, and we nearly sailed it to Abingdon. That was the best thing we ever done, Lyra. I won't never forget that, even if I'm down here dead for 1,000 years.
Yes, but listen, when I ran away from Mrs. Coulter the first time, right, I found the Egyptians again, and they looked after me and... Oh, Roger, there's so much I found out. You'd be amazed. But this is the important thing. Ma Costa said to me, she said I'd got witch oil in my soul. She said the Egyptians were water people, but I was a fire person. And what I think that means is she was sort of preparing me for the witch prophecy. I know I got something important to do. And Dr. Lancelius, the consul, said it was vital I never found out what my destiny was till it happened, see? I must never ask about it. So I never did. I never even thought what it might be. I never asked the alethiometer even. But now I think I know. And finding you again is just a sort of proof. What I got to do, Roger, what my destiny is I got to help all the ghosts out of the land of the dead forever. Me and Will, we got to rescue you all. I'm sure it's that. It must be. And because Lord Asriel, because of something my father said, death is going to die, he said. I don't know what'll happen, though. You mustn't tell him yet, promise. I mean, you might not last up there, but...
That's just what I wanted to tell you. I told them, all the other dead'uns, I told them you'd come, just like you came and rescued the kids from Bulvanger. I says Lyra'll do it if anyone can. They wished it to be true. They wanted to believe me, but they never really did, I could tell. For one thing, every kid that's ever come here, every single one, starts by saying, I bet my dad'll come and get me. Or, I bet my mum, as soon as she knows where I am, she'll fetch me home again. If it ain't their dad or mum, it's their friends or their grandpa, but someone's going to come and rescue him. Only they never do. So no one believed me when I told them you'd come. Only I was right.
Yeah. Well, I couldn't have done it without Will. That's Will over there. And that's the Chevalier Tialis and the Lady Salmakia. There's so much to tell you, Roger.
Who's Will? Where's he come from?
Lyra began to explain, quite unaware of how her voice changed, how she sat up straighter, and how even her eyes looked different when she told the story of her meeting with Will and the fight for the subtle knife. How could she have known? But Roger noticed, with the sad, voiceless envy of the unchanging dead. Meanwhile, Will and the Gallivespians were a little way off, talking quietly.
What are you going to do, you and the girl?
Open this world and let the ghosts out. That's what I've got the knife for.
He had never seen such astonishment on any faces, let alone those of people whose good opinion he valued. He'd acquired a great respect for these two. They sat silent for a few moments, and then Tialis said,
"This will undo everything. It's the greatest blow you could strike. The authority will be powerless after this."
"How would they ever suspect it? It'll come at them out of nowhere."
"And what then?"
"What then? Well, then we'll have to get out ourselves and find our demons, I suppose. Don't think of then. It's enough to think of now. I haven't said anything to the ghosts in case it doesn't work. So don't you say anything either. Now, I'm going to find a world I can open, and those harpies are watching. So if you want to help, you can go and distract them while I do that."
Instantly, the Gallivespians urged their dragonflies up into the murk overhead, where the harpies were as thick as blowflies. Will watched the great insects charging fearlessly up at them, for all the world as if the harpies were flies and they could snap them up in their jaws, big as they were. He thought how much the brilliant creatures would love it when the sky was open and they could skim about over bright water again. Then he took up the knife, and instantly there came back the words the harpies had thrown at him, taunts about his mother, and he stopped. He put the knife down, trying to clear his mind. He tried again, with the same result. He could hear them clamouring above, despite the ferocity of the Gallivespians. There were so many of them that two flyers alone could do little to stop them. Well, this was what it was going to be like. It wasn't going to get any easier. So Will let his mind relax and become disengaged, and just sat there with the knife held loosely until he was ready again. This time the knife cut straight into the air, and met rock. He had opened a window in this world into the underground of another. He closed it up and tried again. And the same thing happened, though he knew it was a different world. He'd opened windows before to find himself above the ground of another world, so he shouldn't have been surprised to find he was underground for a change. But it was disconcerting. Next time he felt carefully in the way he'd learned, letting the tip search for the resonance that revealed a world where the ground was in the same place. But the touch was wrong wherever he felt. There was no world anywhere he could open into. Everywhere he touched, it was solid rock. Lyra had sensed that something was wrong, and she jumped up from her close conversation with Roger's ghost to hurry to Will's side.
What is it?
We're going to have to move somewhere else before I can find a world we can open into, and those harpies aren't going to let us. Have you told the ghosts what we were planning?
No. Only Roger, and I told him to keep it quiet. He'll do whatever I tell him. Will, I'm scared. I'm so scared. We might not ever get out. Suppose we get stuck here forever.
The knife can cut through rock. If we need to, we'll just cut a tunnel. It'll take a long time, and I hope we won't have to. But we could. Don't worry.
Yeah, you're right. Of course we could.
But she thought he looked so ill, with his face drawn in pain and with dark rings around his eyes, and his hand was shaking, and his fingers were bleeding again. He looked as sick as she felt. They couldn't go on much longer without their demons. She felt her own ghost quail in her body and hugged her arms tightly, aching for Pan. Meanwhile, the ghosts were pressing close, poor things, and the children especially couldn't leave Lyra alone.
Please, you won't forget us when you go back, will you?
No, never.
You'll tell them about us.
I promise. What's your name?
But the poor girl was embarrassed and ashamed. She'd forgotten. She turned away, hiding her face, and a boy said,
It's better to forget, I reckon. I've forgotten mine. Some ain't been here long, and they still know who they are. There's some kids been here thousands of years. They're no older than us, and they've forgotten a whole lot. Except the sunshine. No one forgets that. And the wind.
Yeah, tell us about that.
And more of them clamoured for Lyra to tell them about the things they remembered, the sun and the wind and the sky, and the things they'd forgotten, such as how to play. And she turned to Will.
What should I do, Will?
Tell them.
I'm scared. After what happened back there, the harpies...
Tell them the truth. We'll keep the harpies off.
She looked at him doubtfully. In fact, she felt sick with apprehension. She turned back to the ghosts who were thronging closer and closer.
Please, you've just come from the world.
Tell us about the world.
There was a tree not far away, just a dead trunk with its bone-white branches thrusting into the chilly grey air. And because Lyra was feeling weak, and because she didn't think she could walk and talk at the same time, she made for that so as to have somewhere to sit. The crowd of ghosts jostled and shuffled aside to make room. When she and Will were nearly at the tree, Tialis landed on Will's hand and indicated that he should bend his head to listen.
They're coming back, those harpies. More and more of them. Have your knife ready. The lady and I will hold them off as long as we can. But you might need to fight.
Without worrying Lyra, Will loosened the knife in its sheath and kept his hand close to it. Tialis took off again, and then Lyra reached the tree and sat down on one of the thick roots. So many dead figures clustered around, pressing hopefully, wide-eyed, that Will had to make them keep back and leave room. But he let Roger stay close, because he was gazing at Lyra, listening with a passion. And Lyra began to talk about the world she knew. She told them the story of how she and Roger had climbed over Jordan College roof and found the rook with the broken leg, and how they had looked after it until it was ready to fly again, and how they had explored the wine cellars, all thick with dust and cobwebs, and drunk some canary, or it might have been tokai, she couldn't tell, and how drunk they had been. And Roger's ghost listened, proud and desperate, nodding and whispering,
Yes, yes, that's just what happened. That's true, all right.
Then she told them all about the great battle between the Oxford townies and the clay burners. First she described the clay beds, making sure she got in everything she could remember, the wide ochre-coloured washing pits, the dragline, the kilns like great brick beehives. She told them about the willow trees along the river's edge with their leaves all silvery underneath. And she told how, when the sun shone for more than a couple of days, the clay began to split up into great handsome plates with deep cracks between, and how it felt to squish your fingers into the cracks and slowly lever up a dried plate of mud, trying to keep it as big as you could without breaking it. Underneath it was still wet, ideal for throwing at people, and she described the smells around the place, the smoke from the kilns, the rotten leaf-mould smell of the river when the wind was in the southwest, the warm smell of the baking potatoes the clay burners used to eat, and the sound of the water slipping slickly over the sluices and into the washing pits, and the slow, thick suck as you tried to pull your foot out.